Albert's here.
We have four measures to consider. I want to welcome most of you to this meeting. CSHB 668 finance relating to child support enforcement provides for ways to establish paternity, limits the issues to be addressed in child support hearings to establish judgments and enforcement, provides specific procedures for the waiver of support obligations, provides subpoena powers for the documentation of assets in cases where child support is in arrears, allows a child support agency to provide child support non-payment information to credit bureaus and lending institutions, and provides additional remedies for the collection of child support. The first person to be heard is Mr. Vitello from the Department of Revenue. Bruce?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Bruce Vitello, Deputy Commissioner of Taxation for the Department of Revenue. Mr. Chairman, you have summarized, I think, most aspects of the bill very succinctly. I don't know if you would prefer to go through a section-by-section analysis or simply, given the fact that you have other bills before you, to be available for questions.
Well, we have a sectional analysis in our folders. As I understand it, Section 2 allows 50% of the obligor's net disposable earnings to be exempt from assignment for child support.
That's
from assignment
for
orders. How was that figure arrived at as opposed to a higher figure or a lesser figure?
That amount basically was established both to conform with federal law. The other, probably the most overriding reason was our view that by setting it at 50%, although there are a small number of cases where we could exceed that amount, that it would be easier for implementation both by the department and also by employers who bear the ultimate responsibility of withholding.
Section 3
is simply an attempt, or primarily an attempt to remove sexist language rather than alleged fathers getting away from paternity to a concept of parenting. Probably the first major change, Mr. Chairman, is in Section 4, which recognizes the use of scientific testing to establish paternity, or in this case, and I've got to correct myself, parentage.
Is there any scientific test that exists as to fathers who paternity by 95%?
There is a new test, at this point not so new. It's called the HLA tissue typing test developed out of UCLA, which is the first test that has been admitted to actually establish parentage as opposed to excluding parentage. That, with a combination of another test, has allowed probability of up to 99%, and it has been admitted in Alaska courts. Colorado is the only other state which provides for an actual percentage establishing a presumption of parentage on the same test, which is clear and convincing evidence.
This test is already admissible in the courts of law.
That's right. I should indicate that it has been an issue of dispute in some superior courts, particularly in the 4th Judicial District of Fairbanks.
What is at issue there? Saying that it's not reliable?
There are several ways to challenge the admissibility of a test, whether it, first of all, it has to be scientifically recognized. The second is that it was properly administered. And then the crucial question is, in what way should that test be given? And in this particular instance, the statute, if it were enacted, would indicate that it would establish, in essence, parentage, and could only be rebutted by clear and convincing evidence, which is a fairly high standard. In other words, frankly, it would establish parentage. It's very unlikely that if the proper foundation has been laid, that anyone could rebut that presumption.
Is there a question of due process here where a test is elevated to the level where the test is given and then the fact finder can only reject the result of the test by both clear and convincing evidence instead of by considering that test in conjunction with all other evidence and making it weighted.
There's no question that it elevates the test, although, again, the underlying assumption is that it has been submitted to the scientific community that there is no reasonable question as to the validity of that test as opposed to whether it was properly administered. In that respect, I'm not sure that it really raises a due process question. I think it's certainly a policy question that this committee and the legislature could ultimately determine should not be accorded that great weight.
Do we don't need to have language that qualifies that sentence to situations as where the court finds that the test was properly administered and the evidence properly maintained?
Well, of course, that's basically a foundation question, and usually that presupposes a proper foundation for the test has been laid, that is, that it was properly administered, the person that's administering it had the qualifications to administer it. Section 5 is perhaps another, I think, significant change in that, as this committee is probably aware, most of the child support proceedings right now, shouldn't say most, but at least half of them are conducted by the state. What the Department of Law has experienced is that once an attempt is made to establish a level of child support, oftentimes counterclaims are filed to adjudicate custody, visitation, or other property rights, which by law the Attorney General's office does not have the authority to represent the person seeking the child support. Section 5 would make it clear that whenever child support issues arise through representation by the agency, the court is limited to dealing solely with the issue of child support. And it's the best use of our state resources so that our attorneys are able to deal with more cases rather than to deal with disputing counterclaims on what are basically superfluous issues.
Well, the situation where a decree of divorce gives custody to one spouse and requires the other to face the court and requires that the payor of support shall have summer visitation or weekly visitation, and where the custodial parent denies that right. What this does is say that where the state collection or enforcement, Department of Revenue Agency, proceeds against the obligor, that parent cannot raise as a defense in that proceeding that I was denied access to my child.
It does not preclude the defense. It would preclude an adjudication, a counterclaim on that issue. In other words, it would be proper for a person to claim that I should be excused from paying child support for the 3 months in the summer that I had the child in my own custody. That would be an appropriate defense. Or, on the other hand, that obligor to claim that I want the child. I want the court to determine that, in fact, I'm a more fit parent to have custody. And raise that in that case would be precluded.
Can the defendant say that any combination of these things, that my ex-spouse has completely violated the duty to give me physical visitation with the child from Friday night to Sunday night twice a month, spends all the money that I provide on
take care of the boyfriend.
Yes. Can those things be raised in this kind of proceeding, or
not as a counterclaim?
As a defense.
Any defense can be raised, but it would be, and I don't see that as being precluded by this bill. The main problem that we're trying to avoid is forcing the state attorney to have to litigate a question beyond his or her confidence or the authority which this legislature has vested in that office, which is to represent an obligee and ultimately the child to get support. Nothing would preclude an obligor from filing his or her own proceeding against the custodial parent.
Technically, you proceed on the basis of an assignment, do you?
That's right.
So technically, then, the dispute is between you and the parent who isn't paying the child support.
That's correct.
And the rights of that parent against the custodial parent, or the wrongs of the custodial parent, don't bind you. I guess what I'm asking is whether you, as the assignee, can have greater rights than the assignor, where the assignor has violated
conflicting obligations,
reciprocal obligations.
Well, I think, again, that's been a question that's been litigated, and it's, the conclusions have fallen on both sides. The courts in Southeast have, in some instances, dismissed the counterclaims on the basis of the argument that the state did not have the authority to proceed beyond one issue, and that's child support. Others, in fact, the same court in Sitka has come down on the opposite side, and yet two other cases. So, the fact is, the issue is being litigated. It's never been appealed to the Supreme Court, so it's not a question that's been ultimately resolved. This simply attempts to, again, to limit, to clarify, so that we don't have our attorneys wasting time on that issue.
I guess, you know, it's our intent not to reopen the entire custody proceeding as a response to a child support. I do want to make sure that we aren't precluding defenses that apply specifically to the child support case. As long as we've done that, I'm satisfied.
Well, the issue here is not really reopening, because what I'm talking about are issues which arise after the decree has been rendered, not the issue whether the parent who was awarded custody ought to have been awarded custody, but the issue of whether the defendant who was brought to court for non-payment of child support can raise questions of perhaps hiding of the child, or secreting the child or interference with visitation, those kinds of issues in these proceedings. And if not, then whether we have a multiplicity of actions in the sense that that parent defends to the Department of Revenue and then has to file another act, a separate action against the former spouse.
If, again, and Mr. Chairman, you're also an attorney, as you realize, we can come down at least three different ways on the issue, but I would presume that, again, any defense raised, using your hypothetical, if it's raised as a defense against paying support, that would be admissible, or at least that argument could be made, as opposed to claiming as a basis to, in terms of adjudicating a different visitation policy, a different custodial policy, or some other property right, which would be specifically precluded here. One other point I think is important to mention is the catch-22 that we put people in who apply for AFDC. One of the conditions is an assignment to the state, allowing the state to collect. So a person who wants to get support for his or her child through AFDC makes that application. We go into court then to collect against the non-supporting parent, and suddenly what's at stake is whether this, in the usual case, is the mother, is the mother a fit mother. So a woman goes out to get child support or to get AFDC, has to make an assignment, and suddenly, because she's done that to protect her child, she's faced with the prospect of a counterclaim for custody. And that's probably the most frequent example we have. You don't have a divorce at all, necessarily. Sometimes you do. There's been no provision made for child support whatsoever, but you're forcing, under current law, that woman to put the child in jeopardy, her right to that child. So we're saying that should not be an issue that the state should have to make.
You might refresh me on this. Sometimes the obligation to pay child support is interdependent with other obligations. Custodial parent, sometimes it's not.
I think that's true.
Thank you.
title?
Yes.
If it is interdependent, then all the other things are already in the case.
Then presumably the non-payer could say, I was only going to pay child support if...
I had Johnny for 3 months.
Yeah, I had Johnny for 3 months in the summer when I wrote her for the parent. I was told that Johnny was going to summer camp and wouldn't be available to me, that kind of stuff. What you get into. And you could still do that, but...
I think that particular hypothetical, that would be a question of visitation, basically saying.
But you couldn't... It could still be raised as a defense, but it could not be raised... He couldn't use that
as
proceeding
a
to get the court in the action you've initiated to amend the
That's
decree
correct.
Or hold her in contempt or something.
That's correct.
By the way, has the court system commented on this?
Yes, they have.
And they say that's all right.
That's correct. They've actually presented two proposed corrections which have been, or changes which have been incorporated in the House version and section 9.
All right, in section 8, it has a new section of subpoenas, which allows the agency to subpoena persons, books, records, and documents concerning the location of assets. If an individual is 45 days in arrears.
That's right.
And
Section 9, basically, I think, is a restatement of decision, Supreme Court decision made in 19. Which is precise. Young v. Williams, 1978. And specifically incorporates language recommended by counsel to the court system. Most of the remaining sections, I think, are rather non-controversial. I would highlight, however, section 12, which provides for reporting of payment information concerning delinquent obligors, which authorized the agency to provide credit information to credit bureaus as an additional incentive to get proper doors to stay current.
Thank you. Are there other questions on your offer?
Didn't we have some questions when we talked about this before on notice provisions when we make the court order for child support in fact a judgment? Then you can proceed on that judgment against property. There were some questions initially on the notice provision. The notice is adequate both ways.
I think you will find Senator Halford at on page, I'm not sure we're working from the same document, page 5, which is section 4723226, which provides the mechanism to collect all the payment to provide for a hearing. First of all, requires that notice be given to the obligor. The obligor has 15 days within which to respond by affidavit and would be entitled to a hearing. If in that affidavit the obligor, and this is at line 25, if the obligor's affidavit states that the obligor has paid any of the amounts claimed to be delinquent, describes in detail the method of payment, or offers any other defense to the petition, then the obligor is entitled to a hearing. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, maybe it was in the we have a Senate bill before somebody there was something in there on mailing shall constitute service.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I believe
section
11 provides for service based on the last number.
Okay, and that notice meets the conditions of...
That's true in facility rules also. It really doesn't... it provides the same degree of notice that one is entitled to in the civil rules.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
That is true. It would be less than actual notice in some cases, but there are motions you can make in civil practice to file suit, substituted service, this type of thing.
That's correct.
Civil Rule 4. Okay, are there other persons wishing to testify on HB 668? Any other person wishing to testify? I hear none and see none. What's the pleasure of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I would move that we pass the bill out of committee with individual recommendations.
Is there objection? Hearing none. So ordered. Mr. Patel, would you just wait a minute? It can be either registered or certified. There is one question about Section 11. We are moving from a 20-day response period, as is generally the case, to a 15-day response period.
In Section...
Service is achieved by mailing.
That's correct.
And... So you could have a situation where the agency mails notice on May 1st, and if the court and your agency don't receive a response by May 15th, a default could be applied for, and it may be that the receipt of the mailing would be maybe the 5th or the 7th or whatever.
That's correct. That's a possibility. Of course, in that situation, as with any person in the court system, one could move, or dealing with the court could move to set aside the default judgment. One option, of course, which this committee may wish to consider, is simply to lengthen the time.
20 days.
That's correct.
Well, the bill's been moved and we've been picked up on the floor.
Buying pigs in the folk over there. We're going to buy some over here.
Moving on to Senate Bill 520. You have in your folder a proposed committee substitute provided by Senator Fahrenkamp. The CS provides that the department would consult with providers, hospital citizen groups, and the Department of Education to plan and develop facilities to meet mental health needs. The plan would entail consideration of specific groups of mentally ill requiring service and the issue of public versus private ownership. The department would provide a report to the next legislature with specific recommendations for the needs of the mentally ill and the impact of the mental health trust lands lawsuit. There is a sectional analysis also of the proposed committee substitute. And
just a question on the mental health trust lines lawsuit provisions. Are you convinced that the title was adequately broad to protect?
No. We may want to change that. Mr. Pierce?
John Pugh from the Department of Health and Social Services. Just since Senator Halper brought it up, I have a real question about the inclusion of the last piece on the mental health land suit. The reason, and I've talked to Senator Fahrenkamp's aide about this, is that I am not clear that there is any way that there is a connection between the two, and I'll give you the reason for that. The mental health land suit basically has to do with the issue over whether the lands were or were not turned over to the state in a proper fashion and so on. And the only issue in that the expenditure of funds that's come under has to do with whether the expenditure for mental health funds over the years and in the future years will some way offset the amount of the value of the lands. And that's how it's been dealt with in the lawsuit. And in a sense, any expenditure we have would only be added to the tally of the amount of expenditures, and from that standpoint, at any given time, we can give a tally of the expenditures over the years, but as far as having any impact on settlement of the suit, it was not particularly specific to a given area like Fairbanks. It's a comprehensive suit is for a statewide comprehensive suit, and I think from that standpoint, you know, in and of itself, one money to one single area would not have any impact on that at all. So I'm not clear how we would provide a report which would make any analysis in connection to the two, the specific comprehensive center in Fairbanks and then also this. This would be my recommendation that they not be tied together, that they're two separate issues.
Yes.
Well, I don't have any objection to them being tied together. My concern was that the title wasn't sufficiently broad to allow that. That's, I think the question of whether they should be tied together is a separate question on its merits, and I don't know the answer to that. I appreciate your opinion.
Okay. Do you have any other testimony?
I would like to comment to, there's a couple of things. We've been working with Senator Steff just on the draft. This came out late last week. In the findings, in Section 1, where the word on line 22 is young adults, I think the term actually that the staff is thinking of are adolescents, and they were indicating 17, 18-year-olds, those would still be adolescents. And I think that would be a more descriptive term of the individuals that we were talking about in previous bills were adolescents. And that would just be there. Then on page 2 in B, on all of the three, the Department of Health and Social Service shall consider in its plan. Our recommendation and our understanding from the past bills would be that number one would make these, recommend these amendments. The provision of, scratch out additional and put residential care and community-based support programs for the chronically mentally ill adult population. For, just let me comment to that. The main thing is that one of the major issues on the adult chronically mentally ill population is not just providing residential care, but providing community support programs. And in earlier bills, and even in the findings, we talk about vocational training, other kinds of comprehensive services. And so I think that's important to have in there, the community support programs, because we don't want to just have residential care without the educational, vocational, and social programs, life skill programs. Under number 2, there's a similar change, but the provision of residential care, after of the word residential care, and then community-based support programs rather than systems. And then where young adults is for adolescents rather than young adults. Okay, so the provision of residential care and community-based support programs for adolescents who neither fit into an inpatient, and rather than lockup, I would rather, from our standpoint, use the term psychiatric facility. Because I think the word lockup is not exactly the term in terms of psychiatric hospitals. Psychiatric facility, nor can be placed into a normal educational facility. So substitute the word psychiatric for lockup. And then finally on 3, the provision of, and insert acute and long-term inpatient, and then insert psychiatric care to address the state's lack of facilities for, and I would scratch the word young because it's for adolescents, not just young ones, but for adolescents in general, so scratch the word young, but adolescents whose needs cannot be met by private in-state institutions or residential care facilities. So those would be recommended amendments there. And then in Section 3, the request from the Mental Health Division would be to add, after vocational rehabilitation, life skills training, which is particular for adults trying to get them into independence. To add that in to make sure that the purpose of the center is more than just a residential, but also has the life skills training. And then the final in Section 4, which I've already mentioned, is I have some difficulty with the report, including the mental health lens. case. I just don't see that it's closely tied together, and I think there would be some real difficulties in trying to tie those analyses together.
Okay.
Now that we kind of just put our language, detox center fit within the description?
No, it would not.
Mr. Chairman, what I'm concerned about is what the sponsor's feeling is with regard to the section on mental health lands. I think if the sponsor is interested in carrying that provision forward, then we need to look back at the title. If the sponsor doesn't want to, then we need to take it out and avoid the question.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, on that particular question, what Senator Perenkamp was most interested in seeing is the actual number count of how the passage of a bill or the building of a facility or facilities would offset the dollar amounts or the damages to the state in the event the state loses that particular case. And if the department feels confident that they can come at any time and provide us with those types of numbers or that type of report, then I think we'd be happy to take that language from the bill at this point. It was something more of a clarification for the committee's, the resources committee's interest than anything else at this point.
Can the department provide that information?
Yes.
We are presently in the position the attorney generals and the department together are looking at the expenditures on mental health statewide for the mental health land suit. Any expenditures that would be utilized in the next few years prior to any settlement would offset against the amount of money that the state would owe in the land suit. So this $3 million expenditure or any additional one attached to this would offset against that the ultimate settlement in that suit. So there's no question that we could provide that on.
Let's go back. Let's go back to the changes that Mr. Pugh had proposed and see if we can take those in order. On page 1, line 22, strike out young adults and self insert adolescents.
So we're going to ask you not to decide.
Not objection. On page 2, line 7, the sentence would read, the provision of residential care and community-based support programs instead of the provision of additional residential care for the
community-based support programs
for the
property. So ask my house consent.
There is no objection. That's changed. Pages page 2, lines 9 and 10. The proposal is to make the sentence read, the provision of residential care and community-based comprehensive support programs to deal with adolescents who neither fit into an inpatient psychiatric facility nor can be placed into a normal education facility.
So move and ask unanimous consent.
Without objection. On line 12, insert before the phrase long-term inpatient care, the words acute and between inpatient and care, insert psychiatric, the provision of acute and long-term inpatient psychiatric care.
So we're going to ask unanimous consent.
Not objection. That will be done. And then on line 22, after vocational rehabilitation, insert life skills training. Is there objection to that?
So
then we come to line 29 on page 2. The sentence, the report shall also include an analysis of the impact of the plan on the resolution of the Mental Health Trust Lands case, Weiss v. State of Alaska. Proposal is to delete that.
Is the proposal to delete that entire section or to delete that?
Just that sentence.
Question, why delete that?
Excuse me,
why delete that?
My only comment is just that the analysis of that, even though we could do that, would not make that significant a difference to this particular proposal for comprehensive psychiatric services in the Fairbanks area. The mental health land suit is going to stand on its own in terms of how much expenditures there have been statewide, and any expenditure here will be placed into that pool of funds that have been expended to offset against any settlement.
Okay.
And so any additional funds spent in Fairbanks will help to offset the ultimate cost to the state of the land system.
If I may continue, Mr. Chairman, in other words, any monies that are spent in this particular instance here will be removed from any damages that that money in court case.
Right. That is the way that the tactic that the Attorney General's office is taking in the sense of looking at all past expenditures as well as looking at future expenditures.
That's correct. Okay.
To offset against any damages that will ultimately be awarded.
That's what I wanted to make sure of.
Do I call you Commissioner now? Or
I suppose I should.
Commissioner. Acting. Yes. Well, Commissioner, we had another bill, which was 521, which was the appropriation bill. And I'm wondering whether an appropriation for design for construction is in order until the study is done.
Well, I think that we will have to have the plan completed before any design can be done. Section 2, of course, deals with saying that no more than $100,000 would be utilized on the plan itself. That's definitely needed in order to put together the comprehensive plan.
Maybe Mark. No, but I mean, we're talking about private in-state. Right. One of the options that you can look at is private institution. What if the study says there's a need and we have found the Humana Psychiatric Corp of Beaumont, Texas, and they want to, we've invited them to come in and meet this need, and they're going to do that, and we don't need to build a state facility. I mean, that's a possibility, I suppose. Why are we appropriating $3 million now until we know what the result of that is?
Well, I think the idea, one of the ideas that I'm not speaking for Senator Farrenkamp, maybe Mark Boyer can speak a little bit to that, is that a piece of this may well be state facility. And I have suspicion that that's the reason that that was placed in for the time. But that is, there is in there a section to look at the code.
Well, it seems that if we're going to have the appropriation, we shouldn't have the study. If we're going to have the study, we just want to do that anyway. But it would seem that if the study were truly going to be the vehicle for decision, then we should pass the bill with a fiscal note to fund the study and not pass the appropriation bill. I mean, I think we should wait for the sponsor. Yeah.
Let's stay at ease a minute and let the
Commissioner.
The sponsor's view that the appropriation should be made that I guess the study is certain to show us a need for some appropriation. And I'm wondering if the approach might not be to say that in Section 3 of 521, the appropriation made by this Act is for a capital project and subject to AS 3725020. The department may not spend the appropriation under Section 1 this chapter until completion of the development plan. Is that a shift?
I have no problem.
No. Section 2 says that the department may not spend more than $100,000 for the development plan, but it doesn't prohibit the expenditure of the $2.9 million for design before it comes.
I have no difficulty with that. Mr.
Chairman, mm-hmm. When you, if I might ask, when the study is in, what's the time frame when the study is in?
Well, we are to be report back to the legislature 10 days, if I remember right. Is it 10 days after the legislature? The 10th day of the first regular session of the 14th, the last state legislature. So we would be coming back in about the middle of January of next year with the plan.
I guess, Mr. Chairman, I don't see any need then of leaving the $3 million there. It kind of bothers me that we're only talking a couple months difference. They could come back with a plan and start on a $2.9 million design, which we may spend $2.9 million for naught if we're not going to come up with a $30-something million to build a facility later. And since we're going to be in session, I have a hard time going with an appropriation of $2.9 million.
Mr. Chairman, the only argument I might offer for the monies is that with them there and in place and able to be used by the department, we could get started with design and engineering work in the event that the study indicates that there is a need in January rather than June or July of next year.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Could the design funds be subject to a determination by the commissioner that the study justifies proceeding with? That way the money would be available, yet there would have, it couldn't just be spent willy-nilly, even if there's no justification for the plan.
We would have to have justification for facility, and then at that point, the one thing is that $3 million may be high for the overall design if there's only one state building, say, you know, the psychiatric facility, and the others would be in the private sector, the residential care, as well as the adult residential care. From that standpoint, the money could be used at that point coming into the legislature for construction next year.
Well, I think the key is that if the administration goes forward after you spend $100,000 on the plan and the assessment, if the administration goes forward from there on and spends over $2 million in design, at that point, the feeling from the administration should be that the governor will put it in his budget and will support it, and that the facility will actually get built. Not come back to the legislature and say, well, this is your project, you've got to come up with $28 million in one area of the state, or you've wasted $2 million. So the key is that the governor and the administration really make a decision to go forward or not spend money on design. And I don't know how we can say that to do it. That's what
Mr. Chairman, maybe this, again, would be a way of following up on my initial suggestion and make the governor make a determination after the plan is completed that the funds for design, in effect, will be allocated at that point. And the governor will then submit a plan to the legislature for funding construction at the appropriate time or something.
All right. Do you have an amendment you'd like to
amend? We'll prepare an amendment which will incorporate into CS on 521 and circulate that on the floor tomorrow.
We haven't moved 520. One more question.
Yes.
On page 2, line 13, did you suggest we take out the word young and adolescents? I think you missed that one going through.
Right, you did miss it. I meant to comment to that.
Okay, are there any others that we missed?
No, that's
the one.
Page 2, line 13, the modifier of young before the word adolescents. I was moving as unanimous consent. We delete young in that context.
Senator Hofford moves that we report CS 520 amended with individual recommendations. Is there objection? If not, so ordered. And 521 will be circulated with the new language, generally providing that expenditures of the design money will be permitted only when the governor certifies that a development plan has been concluded, which demonstrates the need for the Senate.
And that the executive branch is going to propose appropriations to meet that need. Propose and support appropriations.
Well, we can't say that. Support, but the governor will
recommend
finance.
I mean, that's the question.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, it may be appropriate to have a motion to move that subject to.
Senator Fisher moves that we report CS 521 with language providing that the appropriation for purposes of design will not be expended until the governor has certified that a development plan is complete, which demonstrates the need for a center using
public construction with the governor would recommend appropriations to the legislature for that purpose.
Mr. Chairman, it's essentially to my effect of modified to meet all committee members' concurrence, and I'll sign this tomorrow when I see you.
Well, I'd appreciate it if a committee member would give us your thoughts this afternoon, because we're not necessarily able to amalgamate everyone's individual thoughts.
Mr. Chairman, my thought is that the language be as strong as it can possibly be without being offensive to the administration, but I think the decision should be made together.
Okay, we'll move on then to CS HB 418.
My name is Kent Broman. I'm an aide for Representative Barbara Locker. And, Representative Locker is on the floor right now, and so she's asked me to sit in and read a comparison on HB 418. The effect of HB 418 is to expand existing laws to allow for the increased use of trained service animals for purposes other than seeing by guides. Dogs are now utilized as hearing dogs for the deaf and are trained to retrieve and facilitate immobile persons. Physically handicapped individuals are faced with legal and financial difficulties when these service animals are considered to be outside the narrow definition of guide dog. So she's asking for this piece of legislation.
And the department supports 418. And there is a zero pistol vote. Was there some situation that brought this to Representative Locker?
Yes, Representative Locker had a constituent who was from another state. I believe the state was North Dakota, and they had enacted legislation that was very similar to this, dealing with the service animals for the deaf. And in the past, I think it's been a problem for some individuals that have tried to use those types of dogs on public vehicles when they weren't a seeing eye dog.
I see. What would be, would there be anything but a dog?
No, I don't think
the word dog is stricken and the word animal inserted, and I don't know.
Yeah, it's specifically dogs. So, you know, I've talked to individuals today. It is specifically dogs, Mr. Chairman.
But why is the change being made?
Is that to eliminate
sexist
reference?
I hope not. I think it has something to do with some people had seen the use of monkeys as service animals for disabled people, and so because of that, felt it might be a mistake.
Ms. Jones, I had the same question. Just because another state has passed some law, it doesn't seem enough of a reason for Alaska to just jump and do likewise. Is there a felt need? What is her name? Louise Rude. Have you checked with the Alaska Association for the Blind?
Yes, I have today, and I talked to her, and she is in support of this. It is legislation that's needed because it expands the language. It, you know, puts into law sort of a broader idea of what these animals can do. I mean, in a lot of cases, people are offended by the fact that you're bringing an animal onto a public transportation system. Seeing eye dogs are one thing. They're, you know, they're harnessed, they're muzzled. You're required to clean up after them if they do something there. And there should be the same sort of consideration given to people that need these kinds of service animals, that, for example, the deaf or, you know,
But again, that's all very abstract. Is it demonstrated need in Alaska?
Well, in some cases, the person that had brought this to Representative Walker's attention obviously felt that there was. Not just specifically because it was, she was from another state and had seen legislation there. Does that answer your question?
No, not really, Mr. Chairman.
Well, do you have any public opinion messages or letters?
No, I don't.
Yeah. Like that?
Mr. Chairman, I very much appreciate the opportunity to look into this further and just check it out with a few of the organizations that we deal with, because I get requests all the time, put in a bill for this, put in a bill for that, and so on. And just because somebody comes along, I don't feel it's necessarily appropriate to amend the Alaska statutes, and I really feel that the limits of this.
What is a specific instance where somebody wants to have an animal available for personal health? What's the instance we're talking about?
Well, in this case, first of all, the legislation that does exist is a seeing eye call.
Okay. What is the specific case that results in the request from this individual?
The specific case was, I believe, an individual that had attempted to use a bus service in the Anchorage area and was denied being able to bring their animal onto the bus because it wasn't a seeing eye dog.
And what kind of an animal was it?
It was
a handicap of the individual.
It was called a hearing dog, and the person was deaf.
It was what?
Hearing dog.
Hearing dog.
Well, but that would still be a guide animal.
Correct, and that's why the language was...
I mean, it's still a guide dog. I mean, I don't see what the difference is.
No, because you have to be totally or partially blind under existing law.
Oh, I see. Or...
Is there any possibility that people would claim disabilities they don't have and to bring their animals on public conveyance? I'm asking whether it's possible that...
I think it would be kind of silly to think that people would bring llamas on airplanes or...
You'd be surprised.
That sort of thing. I think that this is... it has to be legitimate. And when you go, let's say, to an airline, you usually notify them, you give them prior notice that you're going to bring an animal on. They, of course, provide space for that animal close to the bulkhead. And the animal must lay on the floor in that space, so obviously it can't be an animal that can't fit into that particular area. Otherwise, they'd have to deny it to be put in the, out in the baggage compartment.
You're not
in
the baggage. Okay. Senator Fisher, could you look into that before our Wednesday meeting?
So I'll try. I'm going to be slightly tired.
Oh, that's right. But I'd like, in fairness to Representative Baca, to move this out and speak if it's been moved.
Well, I can certainly do it on Friday.
Thank you very much. That concludes our agenda for this afternoon, and we will.